STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Welcome to Stand to Reason. My name is Alan Schliemann. I'm one of the speakers here at STR. And I am filling in for Greg Kokel, who is on vacation. He's actually fishing.
Oh, that's nice. Where is he fishing?
He's fishing in Wisconsin. He goes there quite a lot to take a break. And so since he deserves a vacation, we are going to give it to him. And I'm filling in for him this week. So we got a great show planned for you today. This first hour, I have a special guest, who you actually just heard just a moment. And I'll be telling you a little bit more about him and talking about the book that he wrote, which I think is very, very relevant and timely. And then the second hour, I will be taking your calls. So if you have a question, a comment, something that's been puzzling you, or you're in a situation, you want some advice or whatever, you know, I'm happy to talk about it and answer your questions. The number to call in on is 855-243-9975. And if you're calling outside of the United States, the number is 562-424-8229. So that'll be the second hour. So if you call in now, you will probably have to be sitting in a queue for a little bit until we get through this first hour. Okay. Well, let's just jump right in then to our guest here this afternoon. His name is Dr. Scott Keith. He has earned his doctorate from Foundation House Oxford. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
All right. He's the executive director of the 1517, the Legacy Project, which we'll be talking about towards the end, which is also having a conference coming up. So we'll be talking more about that. He's an adjunct professor of theology at Concordia University here in Irvine, which isn't actually very far from our office.
No, so, yeah, just down the road.
That's right. So it was great that he was able to come in and be live in studio. He's also co-host of the Thinking Fellows podcast and, most relevant for this afternoon, he's the author of a book called Being Dad, Father as a Picture of God's Grace, which is what we're here to talk about. So welcome to the Stand to Reason broadcast.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, well, we're glad that you can come in, as I said, and be here live. You know, I think having you here and having you talk about this book is particularly significant for two reasons. Number one, it's almost Father's Day. And
coming right up, yeah.
Coming right up. And so, of course, this is particularly about being dad, which, of course, presumes that you're a father. And so, that is anybody who's, you know, concerned about being dad. Of course, you're going to be a father, and that's something that we all probably want to know more about. And then it's also significant for me because I'm a dad. I'm a father and who's parenting a young boy. And actually, as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, well, this is more than just, you know, an interesting, you know, book about theology or parenting or about, you know, what the book's about. It seemed very relevant for me because I know I find myself wanting to be a good father, thinking that at times I'm a good father, but then also thinking, man, there's a lot of times I really blow it. And I think a lot of fathers probably feel the same way.
Yeah, I sure did along the way or do even still. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's really great that we're able to talk about this. So let me just begin by asking you, maybe you can just kind of give us a 2-3 sentence kind of summary, big picture of what this book's about before we kind of dive into some more specifics.
Yeah, at the end of the day, for me, as I wrote the book, the one thing I did not want it to be was a sort of day-to-day handbook, mm-hmm. Step-by-step, how to be a good dad. In other words, if you do these 10 things, your kids will turn out perfectly. They'll go to Harvard. They'll, you know, get that MBA and have the perfect life and a wife and 2.5 kids. That's mm-hmm. not what it is at all.
Right.
What it is at the end of the day, is an apologetic for God's fatherly love as shown to us in the reflection of our earthly fathers. I think that there's a concept in apologetics called an analogia antis, or an analogy of being, mm-hmm. which says that, you know, it's difficult for us to conceive of God, how good he is, how great he is, how mm-hmm. powerful he is, how loving he is. But one of the ways we're able to conceive of him is by these analogies here mm-hmm. on earth that in a shadowy, reflective way point us to him. Mm-hmm. and that I think that fatherhood and fathers particularly are some of the most sort of relevant analogies to God's grace. And the book sort of tries to unpack that.
Yeah. So I love that. But I'm also terrified by that
because right,
of,
yeah.
of the obvious implications that you're bringing up, which is if I'm a picture of God's grace, of what God the Father is like to my kids, man, how significant, how important is it that I get this right?
Yeah. So, you know, what's funny is that I'll put this in sort of my parlance, and if it doesn't work, you can slow me down. When I first started going out and teaching on the book, when it was released, you know, doing a lot of speaking gigs on the book, in my head, it was a very gospel-oriented message. Mm-hmm. You know, Christ has saved you. He has set you free from sin, death, and the power of the devil. And now you're free to serve your neighbor. And one of the ways that you freely do that is by living your life in the vocation or the calling that he's brought you into, first with those people that are closest to you, your family. And it's a wonderful gospel-oriented thing. And I'd go out and do this, and I'd say that, and right. I'd look at rooms full of terrified men, you know, right. who are only thinking, wow, this is a really heavy burden that you're putting on me. And I sort of had to, in my mind, and for the sake of communicating what it's all about, unpack that a little bit and say, yeah, it is terrifying, but it's sort of wonderfully terrifying mm-hmm. in a particular way. We have to know that I guess it's possible for us to mess it up, but it's unlikely for us to really mess it up if we're just being who God has already declared we are, mm-hmm. which is his child.
Right.
Yeah. And right. so I think we tend to take more of the burden on ourselves that God has intended,
right.
which we tend to do anyway sure. in our salvation and our sanctification and whatever. We tend to try to take all the responsibility when really a lot of that's in God's hands mm-hmm. and he's created you to be something. He's saved you to be something. He's declared mm-hmm. you to be his child. And this is basically just sort of, I like to say it's sort of just getting up and walking through your daily life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I definitely need to hear that. I know both my wife and I feel, and perhaps a lot of parents do as well, a lot of pressure, like as if yeah. it's all dependent upon us. Now, of course, we know that's not the case, but nevertheless, we still act and behave like it is more dependent upon us. And so we kind of see how our kids turn out, and then we think, oh, man, it's because of what we're doing, you know? And there's no question that obviously we play a role. But I like your emphasis to say, hey, you know what? You got to realize, you know, God's involved in this process
right.
in significant ways.
Yeah. And I mean, I'd say that it's just a reality that there's, for the Christian and non-Christian alike, there's really nothing more terrifying than being a parent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can think that there are all sorts of things that would scare us more, but really, there's not. In my experience, there's not. When you are, and one of the messages of the book is this idea of, passing on that freedom that you have in Christ to your kids.
Mm.
Well, there's nothing scarier than freedom, first
right.
of all, because it's sort of uncontrollable. We as parents, our natural inclination is to try to control every situation,
mm-hmm.
mainly because we're scared.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and being a parent is kind of terrifying. And so in order to deal with that, we crowd around and we protect and maybe overprotect. Mm-hmm. And that's possibly not the answer. I think the answer is freedom. The answer is forgiveness. The answer is grace.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom's always scary.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and I know we'll get back to this later on in our conversation about sort of the contrast between giving them gospel and giving them law and kind of the contrast
sure.
that you bring up. So, you know, hopefully we'll touch on that soon. But tell me kind of like how is it that you even see currently the state of fatherhood in the United States today? Like, What is that like in our country? How is that a problem for us as men and as fathers?
It's terrifying, to be honest with you. It's a bad situation. I wasn't really big on putting statistics in the book, but I wrote the first draft and sent it by a couple of my friends. They said, this is really good stuff. It'd be a little more powerful if you'd, you know, give some front loading of statistics. So I did. I had them in the research. And one of the things that I worked through right off the bat was that 42% of children who are born in America will grow up in a home where there is not a consistent father presence in that home, either biological or otherwise.
Wow. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. I do a lot of speaking all over the country on this. And when I'm in more affluent areas, I look out at the audience and there's a lot of disbelief. And when I'm in less affluent areas or more rural areas or more urban areas,
right.
I look out on the crowd and the answer is, oh, I thought it'd be higher.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it'd be closer to 60 some odd
wow.
percent. the social ramifications of that are kind of staggering. I mean, I won't give you all the scary data, but let's just say that, you know, the majority of children who suffer from behavioral problems in school are from fatherless homes. The majority of people that are incarcerated before the age of 26 are from fatherless homes. The majority of convicted rapists are from fatherless homes. The majority of runaways are from fatherless homes. I mean, you could almost take out any social problem that pertains to children and young adults mm-hmm. and say, is there a father in the home? And the mm-hmm. likely answer will be, no, there's not.
Mm-hmm.
In the church, it's almost scarier in a lot of ways because I think the church is one of those places where men generally have been pushed aside. I think that there's been a big movement towards the feminization of the Christian church mm-hmm. generally.
Mm-hmm.
David Moreau's book on that, Why Men Hate Going to Church, is great if your listeners are interested. I think I got his name right. And what's happened is that, so I often challenge people when I'm out speaking, say, hey, look around in your congregation and see how many of these, if there are children in your church, how many of those children are brought solely by their mothers?
Mm-hmm.
You'll probably find that most of them are. I know we do, and I'm a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I know that's greatly the case in our denomination. It's kind of scary. The Swiss in the 90s did a study, and it wasn't particularly aimed at Christians. It was aimed at as part of their census,
right,
of determining generally just, you know, how belief and practicing of a particular belief was passed on from children to adults. And basically, they were just trying to figure out who's who in the zoo type mm-hmm, thing. It wasn't mm-hmm. – they didn't really have an altruistic motive to it. But what they found, and it was widely reported, it's being sort of – the study's being duplicated in the UK. What they found and was widely reported – so if let's say it this way. They asked this question. If you were – put it in Christian terms. If you were raised as a Christian as a child and persisted in that faith actively as an adult,
yeah,
i.e. went to church, raised your family in the faith, blah, 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 who was it that brought you to the faith, mm-hmm. brought you to church on Sunday, brought you to Sunday school, taught you about the Christian faith, mm-hmm. da, 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 as a child? And what they were trying, what happened was they were able to gain some percentages of how many children persisted if it was mom only that brought them to church, how mm-hmm. many children persisted if it was both parents, how many if it was dad only. And it's kind of scary. I usually do this in a Q&A, so you're going to have to maybe play along with me. How many, what's the percentage do you think if both mom and dad were the ones that brought the children to the faith?
That stayed?
Yeah, that stayed. Persisted into adulthood.
I don't know. I'll say 60%.
Okay, so if we land on 60%, we're landing on about the average that currently exists. People who are raised in the faith by 26, only 60% of them will stay in the faith. So
Okay. Generally,
that's how it's working right now. It's kind of scary. The millennials are kind of scaring us because now by age 29, there's a higher percentage of them dropping out than mm-hmm. has normally happened. But take that aside. If both parents are the ones bringing the children to church, it's only about 40% of them that stay in the faith into adulthood. What do you think the answer would be if it was mom only? And which is, I don't know if it's true in every church, but in the churches I visited, it's very often mom only bringing the children.
Yeah, so I'm going to guess lower, but if it's, I don't know, 30%.
Yeah, it's around on the low end, 3%, on the high end, 6%.
3%?
Yeah, 3 to 6%.
Okay, so I'm way off.
Yeah, and then here's the big shocker, and we need to maybe clear this up afterwards, but what do you think the percentage is if it's dad only bringing them to the faith as children? We could do the old game show higher or lower.
Now I'm going to go back up, and I don't even know if I want to guess and embarrass myself again. I don't know. I'll say I'll go with 40%.
Yeah, it's in the high 60s.
Okay.
In some areas where the survey was done, it went all the way up to 80%.
Wow.
Yeah.
So. And do they try to offer an explanation for that?
No. Statisticians are great at not offering explanations.
Sure.
I'd say through my research, this is my hypothesis. It's not that mom is not important. Mom's greatly important. I myself was raised by a single mother. My dad died when I was two. My mother mm-hmm. brought my brother and I both to church, and she was the main faith influence in our lives, and we've both persisted in the faith to adulthood. So the first thing we have to tell your listeners is the statistics are only statistics.
Sure.
They deal with big generalities. They don't deal with individual circumstances. So, you know, single mom out there, don't be hopeless. But my particular interpretation of it is this, is that for whatever reason, there's been a trend towards generally in our society dumbing down the influence of men in the lives of family.
Mm-hmm.
That's gone over into the church as well. Oftentimes what happens is when dad does come along to church, so when it's reported as both mom and dad,
right?
When dad does come along to church, he's oftentimes being drug along like one of the children,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so the stats are better than if mom only, but not as good as if dad is actually fulfilling his calling as the spiritual head of the household mm-hmm. and the one sort of instigating that we need to hear the word, we need God's gifts, and this is where we get them, is how we do it. That's my interpretation of it. I think it's important for both mom and dad to be involved in the mm-hmm. faith lives of their children and the bringing up the children in the faith. But I do think the scriptures are pretty clear that if and whenever possible, the father is to be the spiritual head of his house,
mm-hmm.
and that means that he's not drug along like a child on Sunday morning.
Yeah, he's taking ownership. He's taking leadership.
Yeah.
So just out of curiosity regarding that study, and I don't know if this was teased out in the details, but was it for both boys and girls raised by where a father's involved that the number jumps up that high?
Yeah.
Or was it different for boys and girls? Or
to my understanding of the data, it wasn't differentiated that deeply. I'm sure that they actually did pull that data, but the study I saw didn't reflect it.
Right. So they're mostly just trying to make the point that fathers in general, regardless of whether it's they have a son or a daughter,
yeah,
greatly influences the likelihood.
Right. Absolutely.
That they're going to show up.
Absolutely.
Keep sticking with their faith.
Yep.
Okay.
I mean, it's staggering, right? And
right.
So if we look at that and then we sort of juxtapose that to how we are currently treating men in society, fathers in society, how they're portrayed in the media, how they're portrayed in sort of our everyday discussions, in our vernacular discussions about dads, and then we reflect on how that translates into the mainstream church
mm-hmm.
and, you know, fathers and men's presence in mainstream churches generally. It's kind of scary.
Yeah. Do you have any examples of like how we see this in the church, like how people even in the church are sort of buying into the culture's perception or the dumbing down of men and fatherhood? Or,
well, it's not my specialty, or wasn't the subject of my research, but I'd say generally, you know, over the last six, maybe even 100 years, church more and more has become a female-dominated endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
Moreau points out in his book that while the majority of rostered clergy are men, the majority of people who work in the church are women. It's something like 75%.
Right.
And he even points out that it's reflected in everything from the way the church is decorated to the way it's laid out mm-hmm. to is this a place that where a man wants to be mm-hmm. or not,
mm-hmm.
right? Or is it like going to grandma's house for tea?
Right.
And, you know, these are things that we kind of do thoughtlessly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a man doesn't want to come in and decorate the church,
right?
And generally. And so it just sort of, it plays out in everything. But that's more his, he does a lot on why he thinks that is more than I do. But I think he's right on.
He's
right on.
Oh, even worship music, I was just thinking of just the way a lot of the lyrics are sometimes.
Sure. Very, very heavily emotional, heavily romantic.
Mm-hmm.
Romanticized.
Yeah. Put your arms around Jesus. Let him put your arms around
yeah.
you. It's like, whoa.
And I'm like, I'm good.
Like,
you know?
That's right. I love Jesus. Just it's kind of weird. I don't want to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really great. So I'm talking here with Dr. Scott Keith, who's the author of the book, Being Dad, Father as a Picture of God's Grace. And what we're going to do is just take a quick commercial break, and then we'll get right back with more of him and his book and more Stand to Reason. Be right back.
Are you wondering where to get started as an ambassador for Christ? We've put together a fresh approach to help you grow in knowledge, wisdom, and character. Go to str.org, follow the Start Here link under Training. You'll find fun videos, informational resources, and key articles. The more you train, the better you can engage others with confidence, courage, and grace. Don't miss the quiz at the bottom of the page where you can test the skills you've learned as an ambassador for Christ. Simply follow the Get Started link under the training section at the top of the webpage at str.org.
Do you have a friend, family member, or coworker who identifies as gay or lesbian? Or do you find yourself in conversations about the topic of homosexuality and want to make a productive contribution? Well, if you're either of these people, chances are you're wondering how to navigate those conversations and how to navigate those relationships in a healthy way, but without compromising your convictions. Well, I want to tell you about a new resource I've made called The Truth About Homosexuality, A Compassionate Response. And it's a DVD that includes the most comprehensive presentation of my teaching on this topic that I've ever presented. In this DVD resource, I'll present the truth about what scripture and science says about this topic of homosexuality, but also show you how to communicate it in a persuasive yet winsome and gracious manner. So I hope you'll consider this resource to help you elevate your understanding of this topic and make your conversations with friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian to become more Christ-like. Okay, we are back with more of Stand to Reason. I'm your host, Alan Schliemann. Greg Kokel is on vacation, a much-deserved vacation, and I have with me in studio is Dr. Scott Keith, who is an adjunct professor over at theology at Concordia University in Irvine, and has written a book, Being Dad, Father as a Picture of God's Grace. And so we're talking a little bit about what that book's about and how it's super relevant for all of us who want to be good dads to our children. So, Scott, I want to get back to some of the things that are, I think, really central to the whole enterprise of your book. And that, of course, one of them that I just read over and over and you mentioned of 100 times, I think, was the story of the prodigal son, the parable that Jesus talks about. So maybe you can kind of tell us, I mean, you know, obviously just give us a quick snapshot of the parable because I'm sure most people know it, but tell us, why is it that you included that in there, and what is it? How what purpose is it serving for the point of your book?
Well, I always say when I do this that I would never be one to say that the story of the prodigal son is primarily meant to communicate what a good father is to be. Mm-hmm. Although I think it does that, and it does that by Christ really, he's trying to teach the people there about God the Father and how God the Father saves the lost.
Right.
But in so doing, he really does provide for us a picture of what a good earthly father is by telling its entire story about how a good father reacts to really bad sons.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I love about it is when Christ, and this is everything with Christ, it's just, it's astonishing. It astonishes me every time I read the New Testament, just how snarky Christ is, and I love it. but the reality is that when Christ is trying to tell us about a good father, he presents to us what we would just on our own consider a bad father.
Right.
And what certainly hit the culture at the time would have considered a very bad father.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really what happens is he's got a son that is just like the worst. He's got two sons, an older son and a younger son. I like to say when I go out and teach this, they're kind of typical. The older one is sort of, he does everything right, works, is obedient, all that. The younger one is also kind of typical. He's more rebellious. He's still a son, but he's a little harder to be the son. It's sort of a typical, I have two sons, and it's kind of a typical situation. But this young son, he's a real, you know, he's a real bad guy.
Right.
He comes and he demands his inheritance before the death of his father.
Mm-hmm.
In our culture, that's bad enough.
Right.
Like, we're thinking, I'm not going to go drain my 401k for you now. But in his culture, there was no 401k. There was property and livestock, stock and possessions, and maybe some money, maybe some gold or something like that. And furthermore, he's the younger son in that culture. He had no right to any of the inheritance, even upon the death of his father, let alone before the death of his father.
Right.
So this son is asking for something just ridiculous.
Yeah.
One of the commentators I read said that the moment Jesus uttered the words that the younger son demanded half of the inheritance before the death of the father, there were most likely people in the crowd picking up rocks to stone
him.
That's
right. He just alienated like a huge portion of his audience.
Yeah, the entire culture. And so, but this is what Christ presents as a good father,
right?
Somebody who's in this situation. The father does what none of us even in our own day would do and says, hey, go for it. I've got to declare myself dead. I've got to sell all of your brother's possessions.
Right.
Give half of it to you and go spend it in what we're told is the far-off land. So the good father's first act is to do something that's, to us, really, if we see it from the perspective of are sort of being steeped in the law. Mm-hmm. Astonishingly bad thing the dad does.
Yeah.
And he says, yeah, go do it. We don't really know all what the son does in the far land until later in the story when the older brother reveals he's been keeping tabs on him all along. Mm-hmm. That's what older brothers do.
Yep.
And that he's probably been cavorting with prostitutes and gambling and that type of thing. Eventually, the younger son comes back. We won't do too much on that. And the father, I think, is, as Christ presents the picture of the good father, the father is presented with a choice one more time. Mm-hmm. This bad son is coming back. What do I do? When in reality, he made his choice the moment the son left, because mm-hmm. what we're told in the story is that while the son was still a far way off mm-hmm. on his return, the father saw him, right. took compassion on him, and ran out to meet him. In other words, the father all along, the moment the son stepped off the property, the father decided that he would take the son back when the son came back. Mm. He would make, by our cultural view and by their cultural view, the second bad choice. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take this bad kid back. Mm-hmm. Son comes back. The father not only takes him back, I won't do too much of it for the sake of time, but he not only takes him back, but he gives him everything. He gives him his own robe so that the people mm-hmm. in the town would probably mistake him for the father if they were walking by. He puts shoes on his feet, mm-hmm. Designating him as a son, not a slave. The son's whole plan on coming back was to try to make a deal with his dad to be a slave.
Yeah, right.
And dad says, no, I don't want a slave. I want a son. Here's shoes. You're my son. Here's a robe. People are going to think that you're me. He gives him a ring. Some very good commentators believe this is meant to describe the giving of a signet ring, mm-hmm. a signature ring, with which the younger son could now buy or sell mm-hmm. everything. In other words, he could do this all again the moment he wanted to. He's got the power. He doesn't have to ask the dad or the brother anymore. He can walk into the town office, stamp down
on
the
deed. It's the authority of his father, right?
He can sign for his father and sell it all again if he wanted to. And then he does the thing that really upsets the older brother later on, is he tells the servants, the actual servants, to go destroy the most valuable thing they still own, which is the fattened calf, mm-hmm. and to invite everybody in town. I like to point out that the father is actually inviting everybody who thinks he's an idiot, right? Because everybody in town by this point would have known he made the bad call to let his son go. He made the bad call to bring him back. He gave him the ring, gave him the coat, mm-hmm. he gave mm-hmm. him the shoes. Everybody in town thinks he's an idiot, and the mm-hmm. father says, go kill our most valuable property, host a party, invite mm-hmm. all the people that think I'm an idiot. And so they all come. And then we, enter the second son, the older son, who, quote-unquote, hears the party.
Right.
I'm sure he knows about the party all along. I think he probably worked in the field a half an hour longer that day than he normally would. And hears the party, but doesn't go into the party, stands mm-hmm. outside. Mm-hmm. And again, the father is at a choice point, right? Mm-hmm. The point at which he's got to make a choice. What kind of father am I going to be? Am I going to be the father that my culture would expect me to be and punish now my older son because he's being defiant and not coming into my party? What am I going to do? So the father goes out and he applies just enough law and then jumps in with the gospel, which is really, I think, the key to being a dad, mm-hmm. is to know when the condemnation, the law has already done its work, and then to jump in and be that mouthpiece of grace, that voice of the gospel, that standing in the place of God and forgiveness mm-hmm. for your children, mm-hmm. That apologetic for God that I think is so strong. And he goes out and he meets the older brother and he says, hey, come into the party. Older brother says, I love the change here. Older brother says, I'm not going to come in and celebrate that son of yours who devoured all of our money with prostitutes.
Right.
Why would you do this? The father's got a pretty simple answer. He says, when a dead person comes back to life, you're left with only one choice, and that's to throw a party.
Right.
This brother of yours changes the terms on the older brother. This brother of yours was lost and found, was dead and alive. We could do nothing more. Mm-hmm. So come on. And as the great theologian Robert Farrar Capon says, put on the funny party hat, pour yourself a drink, and have a good time.
Yeah.
You know, he applies the law as he needs to, but when it's done its work, he brings the invitation of the gospel and says, come into the party. There's nothing else we could do. This is who we are created to be. Mm-hmm. This is who we're declared to be, free children of God on account of Christ. Come into the party. Mm-hmm. So it's an amazing picture of fatherhood, and I think it's one that is as culturally rebellious in its own day as it is in ours.
Yeah.
in modern Christian circles, I think fathers are expected to be the ultimate disciplinarians,
mm-hmm.
if they are active, to be the bigger biceps and the louder voice, to always back mom up 100%, to always back up, quote-unquote, the adult situation 100%.
Right.
Maybe they're being called to do what we would culturally consider the wrong thing,
mm-hmm.
and be the voice piece of the gospel, the mouthpiece of forgiveness in their home.
Right.
And if we look at the prodigal son as an example of that, I think it's pretty clear from the mouth of Christ that that's what our heavenly father is, and mm-hmm. he uses the picture of an earthly father to get that across.
Right. You know, so I'm as you were sharing that, I was remembering the chapter, I think it's called The Magic Kingdom? Or
right, yeah. Some,
yeah. And what was interesting, it reminded me of a number of the stories that you put in there about how when there are cases where a son has, you know, royally screwed up, okay,
right.
they've done incredible wrong, of course, parallel to kind of what we're seeing
right.
here in the picture of the prodigal son. And these are real life stories, right? So
right.
so the son comes back or, you know, the father comes, meets his son, and you're expecting the father and rightly so to come down hard on the kid. And by the
right
way,
so.
That's my instinct too.
That's right.
When my son does something really, really wrong,
yep.
I come down really, really hard
that's
on
right.
him. Because that's instinctually
the
what
natural
I'm thinking.
Inclination of
that's
man
right.
is towards the law.
That's right.
Yeah.
But this picture of the prodigal son is different.
It's a juxtaposition.
Right.
That.
Right. So I don't know. I was really taken by those stories.
Can I tell you one?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So a couple years ago, I went to a conference in New York City called Mockingbird, put on by David Zoll. He's got a podcast too. He's a great guy. Anglican theologians. I've gone every year since. I'm not the most sanctified person in my sort of the piety of my everyday life. And so
right.
conferences for me are sort of like opportunities to get work done.
Mm-hmm.
And I very rarely go to the 7 a.m. chapel.
Right.
But this time along, the people who had paid for me to go were going to the 7 a.m. chapel. So I came and I was begrudgingly sitting in the back. I'm pretty sure writing Being Dad.
Right.
And not paying attention. Then all of a sudden the speaker gets up and says, I want to tell you a story about my dad. And I'm like, radar's
yeah.
up.
Right,
and
right.
I've got all my attention because I'm just kind of selfish like that sometimes. And I listen. His name's James Monroe. And he says, when I was 12 and my sister was 7, yeah, or he says, even though my sister and I are great friends now, when I was 12 and she was 7, selfless and forgiving love was not the hallmark of our relationship.
Right.
Like, well, that's sort of natural. Because I remember one day she and I were standing on the second floor landing of our house, and we were having a horrendous fight. We were screaming at one another. And I got so sick of her screaming that at one point when she laid into me again, I balled up my fist, cranked my arm back and as hard as I could, punched her in the stomach.
Mm.
And he says, and just as she opened her mouth to start screaming from my punching her in the stomach, I noticed to my right that there was a can sitting on the table. He points out that, he goes, some of those who are older will remember a time in the United States when it was legal to buy DDT for use in your home gardens.
Oh.
And he says, for those younger among mm-hmm. us, the DDT was such a poisonous chemical that it's now
banned.
Outlawed,
right,
banned.
Right.
You cannot buy it in the United States. He goes, but that was DDT on the table. I picked up the can, and just as she opened her mouth to cry, I stuck the can in her mouth and squirted as much as I could with one squirt directly into her mouth. He says, at that moment, my mother appeared. For all the moms in the audience, I like to say, I don't know what it is about a mother's ability to, like, to take a zipper and open the space-time
right,
continuum
right.
and come out of nowhere.
It's like Jesus, you know, yeah. he just appears.
It's all of a sudden he's in the room,
right.
and they're like, what are you doing here? That's exactly what happened. He says, my mother said not a word. She scooped up my sister, ran down the stairs, out into the street, flagged down the first car that came by, and went to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for all of us who grew up in Southern California, this guy's a little older. I'm sure this was in the 50s in some nice little Midwestern town where it was safe to flag down a car and
right,
go to the hospital.
Right. And there was people who actually cared about right. others that would actually pick them up.
So his mom's at the hospital. And he says, and I stand there and I waited. He says, eventually I went up to my room. I sat on the edge of my bed and I waited. I waited for what I knew would be inevitable, and mm-hmm. that would be my father. He says, not long after, I heard the door open and shut. And I heard the footsteps on the stairs that I knew belonged to my father, and I knew the apocalyptic second coming was about to happen, and it was about to happen in my
right.
bedroom.
That's right.
He says, my dad opened the door. He looked at me, and he saw on my face the hurt, the despair, the sorrow, the fear in my eyes, and he simply knelt down and opened his hands wide. And Pastor Monroe says, and I ran to him like a shot. And his father wrapped his arms around him, and he ended with a line that I'll never forget. He says, "And I can still feel those arms around me to this day, and I know whose arms they really are. They're the arms with nail-scarred hands."
Mm.
That's what the book's about.
Right.
It's about being that model of grace to your kids. Because we, when we are raising our kids in the faith, we every Sunday get up, you know, make them eat their cereal, get dressed, put them in the car, mm-hmm. take them to a place. And then at that place, we say, "Hey, listen, there's a guy out there we're going to call God the Father, a man who is so good and who loves you so much mm-hmm. that another man, his son, was sent to die for your sins so that you might have life and have it eternally and abundantly."
Mm-hmm.
That these two men conspired to save you. And we ask them to believe this, and we ask them to believe this, and we ask them to believe this. And then the only pictures we want to give them are heavy-handed men or absent men or bumbling men
mm-hmm.
or men who don't look anything like this person that we preach to them about on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if we reframe that a little bit, it's not that they're a good dad will ever be just like God the Father, but he won't be completely unlike God the Father to his kids mm-hmm. either. Mm-hmm. He'll be an analogy, right? He'll be a foggy picture, a mouthpiece of grace that reflects the forgiveness that that father has in Christ.
Right.
And reflects it back on his own children. Makes it, I think, easier for children to believe
mm-hmm.
this gospel that we hand to them, hand over to them every at every opportunity, hopefully.
That's why you say it's an apologetic for God in this sense.
Yeah, it is.
So, you know, in that story, it's just, it's such a great story. And there's a number of stories like this.
Yeah, that's one of many.
Where, you know, kids, you know, total the car or whatever. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, man, when that father comes home, he's going to, you know, lay into that son, right? So, but in the story that you just told, the father comes home and you said he sees on the son's face the tears, the anguish, the, "I know I royally messed up.
Right.
And so it's almost as if it is the case that there's nothing more needed in terms of law. The law, I mean, in the sense of the kid realizes what is wrong. And that's the purpose of law, right? And you're saying.
Yeah. And I'd say it's only our own sin that makes us believe that adding more law to an already broken person will make the situation better.
Right.
It's not that we actually think it's going to make the situation better. It's that it makes us feel better about the situation.
Mm.
And so we add more law to it.
Yeah.
We add more condemnation to it. When there's. Condemnation is already there. You know, law and condemnation is already readily abundant in the lives of children. Even mm-hmm. the children that we think are the most wild and crazy, undisciplined children we'd have ever seen, they have more law in their lives than we realize. Children, on the whole, even in very permissive households, don't decide when to wake up, don't decide when to go to sleep, don't decide what to do with their own day, don't mm-hmm. decide whether to go to school or not, whether to do homework or not, mm-hmm. whether to go to soccer practice or not. That is all decided for them.
Yeah,
their lives are dictated by the law.
Mm-hmm.
The magic kingdom is when somebody steps in and says, "The law has already done its work. The condemnation has already done its work.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for you to be set free."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the mouthpiece to do it on behalf of Christ.
Yeah. See, this is the mistake I make, is I think if by giving more law, this will help, you know. But really, as you said, it only helps. It helps me. It helps me feel better.
Right.
Thinking that somehow it's doing good for my son or my daughter, whatever the case might be, but it's not. And I just love it.
Well, and it's not easy. I make it sound simple. But
just do that.
Yeah. The funny thing is that it's not, right? It's something, this is a forgiveness cycle for every father, I think. It is for me in my life. I mean, even not too long ago, I remember my kids are grown. We had them all over. We have a habit of going to new movie releases together, and they were all down at our house, and my wife made dinner. My son, who's grown, rents his own apartment, pays his own electric bill, was hungry before dinner.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest one is holding the fridge open, letting all of the cold air that I'm paying for out into the house. And I, you know, lose my temper with him, and I say, "Caleb, would you close the door?"
Right.
And he looks at me, just a dead face, and goes, "Dr. Scott Keith, author of Father is a Picture of, or Being Dad, Father is a Picture of God's Grace, doesn't even have patience with his own kid holding the fridge open," you know?
Oh, man.
And so this isn't to say that we do this well all the time. We're forgiven constantly. I mean, mm-hmm. we live in the forgiveness that Christ has has given us, even in this, even in our, and maybe even especially in our failures in this area. But our, just because we're not always successful, it doesn't mean that we should retreat to the idea that the law is the answer.
Sure. No, I think it's a great point. So what, I mean, I'm just thinking, I know I feel this a little bit inside me, and there might be other people who are listening who might fear this as well, but is there any way, is there a risk in which a father who comes in and provides that huge measure of gospel and not additional condemnation, is there any risk in doing that? Is there a possibility where that could be misunderstood by the child?
Yeah.
And what might be a circumstance where that might happen? Because I think the authoritarian in me, the strong law man in me wants to think, oh, no, if I did that, he won't get it. He won't get that what he did was wrong or something like that.
Right. We can rest on a couple things. First, I think we make a big mistake, especially culturally, that we interpret grace and graciousness as permissiveness, and it's not.
Okay.
The only way a person can be forgiven is when there's been a wrong done and acknowledgement of that wrong done, right? So in other words, the wrong is done. I always say when I go out and teach this book, I assume that your kids have messed up royally, and I assume they've either been punished by you, your wife, their teacher, or just the natural consequences of their actions.
Right.
And I'm trying to ask the now what.
Mm-hmm.
Now what? Right? They've messed up. Something's happened. You've yelled at them. Your wife has yelled at them. A teacher's yelled at them. They've been, you know, spanked, time out, whatever. Or they've just done something dumb in the world, gravity or otherwise, has paid them the consequence, right?
Right.
Now what? Now what? What's your role? What's your vocation as father?
Mm-hmm.
Is your vocation as father to step in once they've already been trodden down and, you know, give them the boot a couple more times? Or is your vocation as father to come in as the mouthpiece of forgiveness, the mouthpiece of grace, and to let them know that it's okay? In this sense, it's okay because they're forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
It's not okay because the act was okay. It's okay because they've been forgiven. And then you can talk about the now what. But you talk about the now what from a perspective of forgiveness and not from the perspective of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the law, that sense, natural sense of condemnation is the
right.
is not the gospel, is mm-hmm. the one thing the scriptures promise is natural to all people born to this world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Paul is very clear in that in Romans and other passages of Scripture. The law, that natural sense of condemnation, is in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
What's not, what's alien to us, what's the external voice, the outside of us voice, is the message of forgiveness on account of Christ, which is the gospel.
Mm.
And I think that's our primary role as fathers. It doesn't mean that we will never discipline. Of course we'll discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you were to ask my kids, they would not say they grew up in a permissive household.
Right.
You know, but I would hope that they would add, no, dad wasn't permissive, mom wasn't permissive, but they did forgive.
Mm-hmm.
That's the goal.
That's great. That's a great distinction there. So we are supposed to be taking a commercial break, but I'm going to actually skip it for now since we got some more things to talk about before the end of our time. But just as a reminder, I'm talking right now with Dr. Scott Keith, who is an adjunct professor of theology at Concordia University in Irvine. He's the executive director of the 1517, the Legacy Project, which he'll talk about in just a moment before we finish up, but also the author of Being Dad, Father as a Picture of God's Grace. And you can get this on Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon's a great spot to get it.
All the usual places. So just I want to get back to another thing here that I think – this book raises the question about masculinity and what that looks like. Because I think, I mean, clearly there's a lot of confusion about that in our culture. But I think even amongst Christians, I found even in the last year or two, as I've talked to my wife, you know, what does it mean to be masculine? What does it mean for her to be feminine? And of course, you know, our roles are unique and different. And I know you talk a lot about that in the book. So maybe you can kind of give us an idea of sort of what's your take on this.
Yeah, I think that we have two sort of views of men in our – maybe three in our culture. You've got the bumbling buffoon or the hyper macho, you know.
Right.
And I would say that true masculinity is neither one of those. I think that the father presented in the parable of the prodigal son is the most masculine – man I've ever seen presented in my life.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't conform to the sort of current standards of his society, he's courageous enough to go against him because what he believes is right is to love his children at all costs.
Right.
So he's strong, but his strength is revealed in his compassion. He's powerful, but his power is revealed in his ability to forgive and to set free. He's gracious. He shows an immense amount of empathy, and he still still grabs hold of and uses his authority as the head of his household when needed. And you see this a couple times when he's talking to the older son, when he's talking to his servants, even in his knowing that he still has the authority to forgive his younger son. He's showing that he's got the power and authority to do what he needs to do and that his word will be followed. That's the picture. Strength is part of it, but it's not, you know, it's not more muscles necessarily. That can be part of it, but that's not its essence. You know, it's not what it is at its core.
Right.
At its core, it's strength through forgiveness. It's power through the proclamation of grace. It's an anti-cultural message, to be honest with you. I mean, beards could be involved.
And you have an epic beard. Just let me attest to that. Since...
But other than that, you know.
Yeah, I got probably like six to seven more inches to grow.
It's just patience.
I know. Patience, you're right. Well, you know, as you describe that picture, I mean, that I can find in myself this longing to be masculine in that sense, the way the prodigal, the father and the prodigal son is like. And I do long for that. A sub sort of topic within that masculinity was this concept of philia that you talked about. I wrote down a quote here. It says, "Masculine men have a true sense of brotherly friendship and love, or philia. They will find that other masculine men with whom they surround themselves, men they know they can trust."
Yeah.
And so I wanted you to comment about that because I find, at least in our culture today, especially even amongst Christians, this notion of philia, this kind of brotherly love, almost feels a little awkward. I feel like a lot of men tend to not want to be affectionate with other people, but I think when I've given it or when I've received it, I've appreciated it. And I don't know if there's some sort of aversion to, you know, homosexuality that they feel or something like that. Like, oh, well, that might not look right or something. But I'm saddened by that because of the men that I know that I'm close to. And I would say I love these men and they love me and they care for me. We are affectionate and I appreciate that, but I find it's uncommon.
It is. And I think we've made it a joke. The bromance is the joke, right? And it's not that. I mean, C.S. Lewis writes extensively about this in his book, The Four Loves, which is probably where I stole everything that I wrote on the subject. But the reality is that in order to – so I say what I said, being masculine, you know, and your willingness to go against the society, the cultural norms, you're forgiving, you're loving, you're compassionate, you're kind – You're strong and you're powerful, but your power comes in unknown ways, right? Mm-hmm. Unknown ways to the world. It comes through forgiveness and graciousness. That alienates you. So unless you can surround yourself by a group of men with whom you can have philia, whom you can have brotherly love to support you up in what Martin Luther in one of his confessions calls the mutual conversation and consolation of the brethren, right? That coming together, he calls it sacramental for Pete's sake. He says that when the brothers come together in this mutual conversation, that it's near sacramental. It's near, it's a holy thing, in other words. And that's because if you were to go on being the mouthpiece of grace to your children in the home, you need somebody to be the mouthpiece of grace to you because you're going to fail.
Right.
You need to be walking alongside somebody and somebody telling you that they're proud of you for doing that, somebody forgiving you for when you've failed. That can be a pastor, that can be a friend. You know, I guess I would caution guys to say that could it be your wife? I don't know. I think men need other men.
Yeah.
I think men need other men. Not need in like the survival sense. Of course, you could survive without philia, but in order to make your life quality, in order to sort of be able to persist yourself in this effort to be a good man and a good father, you need other men around you to support you in that. And that's going to involve some affection. You know, I've got a couple of my friends that when we part, say, I love you.
Yeah.
And it's not meant, you know, in a bromance sort of way.
Sure.
It's meant in a fact that, yeah, no, I actually love this person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, someone standing outside of that relationship who would hear that would be like, wow, that's kind of odd. I mean, yeah. They may not think it's anything, you know, odd about
two
it.
Two big bearded guys. And, right, I love you, bro.
Right, right. Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, I also suspect that by men feeling the freedom to have this philia kind of brotherly love with other men, showing affection, that this also models for our children what true friendship, true affection should look like with other men as well. And perhaps even as we show affection and men are affectionate with their sons, that this also communicates love and another sense of perhaps grace.
Yeah.
That would be a picture of what God gives to us.
One of the things I say often when I'm teaching this is, you know, to kind of drive the point home, is I say, how I think we all want, speaking of young boys particularly, we all want our young boys to grow up to be good men. We maybe even want our young boys to grow up to be good fathers. But how do we expect them to grow up to be good men if they've never seen one or never seen two interacting with one another?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we expect them to grow up to be good fathers if we've never presented them any particular father as good?
Mm-hmm.
Or had another man, you know, present them as good? It's a good question, and I think it's one we need to wrestle with. I mean, this is for the people who don't necessarily think that this is a crisis. You know, refer to the statistics at the beginning of the show. It really is. It really is. 42% of all children in the United States are growing up without a father. Mm-hmm. Social ramifications are staggering. Spiritual ramifications are equally staggering. This might be something that we might want to think about and try to get a handle on.
Yeah. So, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of this big picture of what of being a father and how that looks as a picture for God's grace. What, I don't know, for lack of a better word, practically can we do? Like, if you could say, well, here are some things that could immediately put these principles into practice with your family today. Like, what could you do that, is it too big picture-ish of a thing?
It's not. I mean, when I first did this, I was really like dead set. I'm not doing practical stuff. And then you go out and do it. Speaking game.
And everyone wants to know.
And you're like, okay, this is all practical to people.
Well, I mean, I think it's so true. Yeah. And I think it resonates with so many people what you're saying. But then sometimes people feel like, man, where do I even begin?
Sure.
I mean. Well, obviously we're saying, well, we should get the book and read the book, and that'll help feed your mind and your soul about what's going on here. But
I'm going to say the first thing pretty simply. Be confident enough in your instincts as a father to act on them. You know, our instincts, I think, are sometimes to the law. But very often, I think that's society pressing down on us. I think very often our instincts are to step in and to save, you know, step in and forgive.
Mm-hmm.
Follow those instincts. What this gets to when you get to the practical, it's a matter of vocation or calling. And, you know, the simplest way to answer how do you be a good dad is, it's going to sound both vague and specific at the same time, is just to wake up every morning and do it to the best of your ability. Rely on Christ and his forgiveness for when you fail, and then wake up the next morning and do the same thing. That may not sound simple, but I can tell you that when I am living, let's like take my vocation as husband as an example, when I am living out my vocation well, it's not very complicated, and yet it's very complicated. When I live it out well, it means that when I wake up and our kids aren't in the home anymore, so it's just my wife and I.
Yeah.
When I wake up in the morning and I stumble to the coffee maker and make the coffee, and I'm still exhausted and need that first cup of coffee to get me going, and I pour a cup, I actually remember to pour that second cup too, and to take it and hand it to my wife, give her a kiss on the cheek, and tell her I love her.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, doing that and then doing that in the next thing and then asking her forgiveness for when you fail and God's forgiveness for when you fail and being forgiven on account of Christ in both cases and moving on to the next thing, that's it. And it's the same thing with being a dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go be that dad. Go hand out that forgiveness. And when you stumble and fall, know that you're forgiven in Christ and try again. And when you stumble and fall, know that you're forgiven in Christ and try again. This is the Christian life. It's both very glorious and not glorious at the same time. The great Lutheran theologian Gerhard Ferdi has a little saying, I'll paraphrase it, his little talk that he gave, and he was a seminary professor, teacher by profession, And he says that students often wanted him, when they would ask him, what does it mean to be a Christian and to live the life of good works? They often wanted him to say it meant, you know, manning the barricades or going on a short-term mission trip or something like that.
Right.
And they were often disappointed when he'd look at them and say, well, it means being the best student you can every day. They'd be disappointed. And I'd say, well, it's kind of the same thing here. What does it mean? It means being a dad to your kids, whenever that specifically looks like in your everyday life, but knowing that your particular calling is unique from mom, it's dad, and part of that uniqueness is to hand over freedom, to be that mouthpiece, that picture of God's grace in the home. Yeah. It's not that moms can't do that, by the way, but I think it's a very particular calling to men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, no, I appreciate you answering that question, because I know even at the beginning, as I read the book, you're like, this isn't a kind of a self-help book in that sense, or super, super, you know, do these five things. But I will say, and I'll, you know, for the listeners too, I think as I read it, I just found myself an attitude shift where I was recognizing in the examples that you give and the stories that you give situations where I am being authoritarian. I am being all law.
Right.
I am trying to add more. You know, and all the different points you bring up, I found myself saying, oh, okay, I see where I'm doing this. Because for every person, it's going to be unique. The practical application will be unique to each person because of the unique relationship you have with each of your children. So I think I encourage our listeners to get the book, read it, and as you do, I think it's transformative. So
Nothing teaches like stories, and there's a lot of stories in there.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, that whole section on the Magic Kingdom and all the stories of fathers being, you know, giving grace when you just think, man, there's no way grace is possible here.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm like, wow.
In fact, you're actually thinking grace is the wrong thing in this situation.
I know. And so,
can you imagine applying that to your own salvation?
Yeah. I know. Well, that's the thing. Thank God, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. If we expected God to behave the way I behave with my kid, I'd be toast.
That's right.
I'd have no chance. You know,
therein is the point.
I know. That's right. So that's why it's wonderful. So we just have like 2 minutes here.
Sure.
I want you to tell me about what's up? Oh, okay. Really quickly, the 1517 Legacy Project is a conference about.
Tell me. We're hosting a conference. Here We Still Stand. It'll be in San Diego, October 19 to 21, celebrating the 500th year of the Reformation. Great speakers. I'll be there. Stephen Paulson will be there. John Warwick Montgomery, Rod Rosenblatt. People should check it out. It's herewestillstand.org.
Herewestillstand.org for more information about that in San Diego. And I appreciate you to coming in studio and talking about your book. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Scott Keith.
Yeah.
Take care. All right. That's all we have for you this first hour. Next hour, I'll be taking your calls. If you want to give me a call and ask a question, 855-243-9975 is the number. And I'll be happy to chat with you after the break. So look forward to more Stand to Reason in just a moment. See you then.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.